A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those prompts where the question itself is a diagnosis. He's essentially asking whether anyone has built a store that only stocks things that don't break. Not a camping store. Not a kitchen store. A generalist buy-it-for-life emporium where the unifying principle across every category is durability. He brings the same purchasing philosophy whether he's buying a $3 pen or a $30,000 car. And he's finding that the signal-to-noise ratio on marketplaces, AliExpress, Amazon, local suppliers, has gotten so bad that finding the good stuff feels like archaeology. So the question is, has anyone actually set this up? Brick and mortar or online? And if not, why not?
This is the paradox of abundance. We have access to more products than any generation in history. Millions of SKUs, same-day delivery, AI-powered recommendations, and yet the experience of shopping has become a game of dodging algorithmic landfill. The more data we have, the worse the curation gets. Because the incentives of the marketplace are fundamentally at odds with the incentives of the durable goods buyer.
More data, worse curation. That's the tension right there.
It's not subtle. Amazon's algorithm doesn't surface the best-made stapler. It surfaces the stapler with the highest margin, the fastest turnover, and the most sponsored ad budget. The durable option is buried on page 7, right next to the off-brand phone chargers that will catch fire in your outlet. So the prompt is really asking, in a world where every marketplace is optimized for churn, can you build one optimized for permanence?
Which is almost a philosophical question disguised as a shopping question. Can you build a business around customers who, by definition, don't need to come back?
That's exactly the problem. And it's the reason the answer to has anyone done this is mostly no, but not entirely no. There have been attempts, and they're instructive. The most ambitious one was called Kaufman Mercantile.
I remember Kaufman Mercantile. Felt like a museum gift shop where everything was the artifact.
Launched in 2012 by Sebastian Kaufman. The idea was beautiful. A general store for the 21st century, stocking only products that were well-made, durable, and designed to last. They sold Japanese chisels, German scissors, American denim, French kitchen knives, Italian espresso makers. Every product was researched, vetted, and presented with a kind of reverence. The copy on their site read like a love letter to manufacturing.
The slow store.
That was literally part of their branding. They positioned themselves as the antidote to disposable culture, and they built a loyal following. People who were willing to pay a premium for a kettle that would outlive them. But here's what happened. In 2018, they were acquired by Huckberry, and by 2020, Kaufman Mercantile was shut down entirely. The store couldn't achieve profitability, despite having exactly the kind of customer base you'd think would sustain it.
Was it the inventory turnover problem?
That's the big one. If you sell a $100 cast iron skillet that lasts 50 years, your customer buys one skillet and never comes back for another skillet. In a traditional retail model, you need repeat purchases to cover your fixed costs: rent, staff, marketing, shipping infrastructure. The lifetime value of a buy-it-for-life customer is, paradoxically, quite low. They buy once, they're delighted, and then they disappear for a decade.
The best customer is also the worst customer.
And Kaufman Mercantile tried to solve this by expanding their catalog, adding more categories, more products, more price points. But that diluted the curation. You can't be the store that only stocks the best if you also need to stock enough things to keep the lights on. The mission and the economics were in tension from day one.
It's like opening a restaurant where every meal is so filling that nobody ever orders a second course.
The other problem was customer acquisition cost. Kaufman Mercantile's target audience was small, people who care deeply about the metallurgy of their kitchen shears. To reach that audience at scale, you need to spend on digital advertising, content marketing, SEO. But the margins on a 50-year skillet aren't high enough to justify a $50 cost per click. Compare that to a company selling subscription razor blades, low product cost, high margin, recurring revenue, infinite ad budget.
The razor blade company can outspend the cast iron company 10 to 1 on customer acquisition because they know the customer is coming back every month. The cast iron company gets one shot.
This is why the market has structurally selected against durability. It's not a conspiracy, it's just math. If you can make more money selling something that breaks, the capital flows toward the thing that breaks. The durable option becomes a niche, a luxury, or a hobbyist pursuit.
Kaufman Mercantile is the cautionary tale. What about the retailers that are still standing? Who comes closest to this vision?
The closest living relative is probably Huckberry, which makes sense, since they absorbed Kaufman Mercantile's DNA. Huckberry started as a men's lifestyle newsletter and evolved into a multi-category retailer with a strong point of view. They sell outdoor gear, apparel, everyday carry items, home goods, even some furniture. Their curation is genuinely good. They carry brands like Darn Tough, Red Wing, Filson, Peak Design, but they're not a buy-it-for-life store. They're an adventure lifestyle store that happens to stock durable things. You'll find a wool blanket that'll last a century, but you'll also find a novelty bottle opener shaped like a Sasquatch.
The Sasquatch bottle opener is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
It's the canary in the coal mine. The moment you stock the Sasquatch bottle opener, you've signaled that curation is secondary to conversion. And look, I don't blame them. Huckberry is a business, and they've been successful. They've opened physical stores in Austin, San Francisco, and a few other cities under the name The Shop. But walk into one, and you'll see what I mean. It's an outdoor heritage vibe, not a durability. First filter.
The aesthetic of permanence, not the substance.
And that's a pattern you see across the board. Muji has the minimalist aesthetic, but their products are not particularly durable. It's design-forward disposability dressed up as simplicity. Snow Peak makes gorgeous titanium camping gear at eye-watering prices, but it's a single-category niche. REI stocks some buy-it-for-life products, cast iron, wool socks, climbing hardware, right next to a wall of disposable hydration bladders and plastic tent stakes that'll snap on their second outing. The durability is incidental, not structural.
REI is basically a co-op where the durable goods and the landfill share shelf space.
That's the key distinction. These stores are organized around activities or aesthetics, camping, minimalism, heritage workwear, not around the principle of durability itself. Nobody has built a store where the sign above the door says, "Everything in here will outlast you. If it doesn't, we don't stock it."
Which brings us to the physical store problem. Is it even possible to do this in brick and mortar?
The economics are brutal. Let's say you want to open a buy-it-for-life general store in a mid-sized city. You need to stock lighting, hardware, kitchenware, stationery, tools, maybe some furniture, maybe some electronics accessories. For each category, you need to find suppliers who make durable products, negotiate wholesale terms, and carry inventory. Your per-unit costs are high because you're buying small quantities of premium goods. Your inventory turnover is low because nothing breaks. Your foot traffic is limited because your target customer is a tiny slice of the population, and your average transaction value, while high per item, doesn't repeat often enough to cover rent.
You need either very high margins or a very different business model.
High margins on durable goods are hard to justify. If a cast iron skillet costs $40 to manufacture and lasts 50 years, what's the fair retail price? $100? $150? Compare that to a non-stick pan that costs $8 to manufacture, sells for $40, and needs replacing every 3 years. Over 50 years, the non-stick buyer spends $660. The cast iron buyer spends $100. From the retailer's perspective, which customer do you want walking through the door?
The one who burns their eggs and blames the pan.
And this gets at a deeper truth. Durability is a feature, not a business model. You can build a brand around durability. Patagonia does it, Darn Tough does it, Red Wing does it, but those are single-category manufacturers, not multi-category retailers. The retailer's job is to aggregate demand and move inventory. Durability actively works against moving inventory.
The physical store model has struggled, which is why the prompt also asked about online. Has anyone cracked this digitally?
This is where it gets interesting. The closest thing to a buy-it-for-life general store is not a store at all. It's a community. The subreddit r/buyitforlife has over 1.5 million members. It's a crowdsourced curation engine where people post products that have survived decades of abuse. Boots, backpacks, toasters, screwdrivers, office chairs. The community vets these claims, debates materials and manufacturing changes, and maintains a wiki of recommended products across dozens of categories.
1.5 million people essentially doing the curation work that a store would need to pay staff for.
And the quality of the recommendations is high because the incentives are aligned. Nobody on r/Bifle is trying to sell you anything. They're just people who are unreasonably excited about their 20-year-old rice cooker. But here's the gap. There's no storefront. You can browse the wiki, find the perfect desk lamp, and then you have to go hunt it down on some other site, where you'll immediately be shown 17 knockoffs and a frequently bought together carousel of junk.
The community does the curation, but the commerce is still a mess.
That gap has been sitting there for years, unfilled. There's also Project Farm on YouTube, over 5 million subscribers, one of the most rigorous product testing channels on the platform. He tests everything from motor oil to ratchet straps to work boots, with actual quantitative metrics. He'll put 10 brands of socket wrenches through a torture test and show you exactly which one fails and how. It's incredibly valuable. But again, no retail arm. He's not selling the winning products. He's just informing your purchase decision and sending you off into the wilderness of Amazon search results.
Project Farm is basically the Consumer Reports of YouTube, but with more hydraulic presses.
More soothing voiceover. But the point stands, the knowledge exists, the community exists, the demand exists. What doesn't exist is the thing that connects them into a transaction. And that's weird, right? In an era where you can buy a car on your phone in 4 taps, nobody has built a, here are the 10 best desk lamps, ranked by repairability, click-to-buy platform.
Why hasn't someone built that? It seems like an obvious opportunity.
I think there are a few reasons. First, the affiliate model doesn't align with the mission. If you're earning a commission on every purchase, you're incentivized to recommend products that generate the most sales volume, not the ones that last the longest. A Bifle affiliate site would make less money than a top 10 gadgets of 2026 site because the Bifle reader buys once and never clicks another affiliate link.
The incentive structure poisons the curation at the root.
Second, the vetting is hard. To claim something is buy it for life. You need longitudinal data. You need to know how the product performs over years, not just out of the box. That means either waiting a decade to launch your store or relying on warranty data, material science, and community reports, all of which are messy and imperfect. A manufacturer can change their supply chain tomorrow and turn a Bifle product into a dud overnight. The store's reputation would be tied to things it can't control.
Which is the same problem Consumer Reports has always had. By the time the reliability data is solid, the model has been replaced.
Third, and this is the one that keeps me up at night, the legal exposure. If you market yourself as the store that only sells things that last, and someone's kettle breaks after 3 years, you're getting sued. Not the manufacturer, you, the retailer, because you made a claim about durability that the customer relied on. Even if you win the lawsuit, the cost of defending it could sink a small operation.
The promise itself is a liability.
It's a marketing claim that invites litigation. Compare that to Amazon, which makes no promises about anything and just connects you to a seller in Shenzhen who will evaporate the moment you file a return.
The legal system punishes honesty and rewards opacity. Of course it does.
Given all of that, the economic headwinds, the incentive misalignment, the vetting difficulty, the liability risk, the fact that nobody has built a true Bifle general store at scale is not a market failure. It's the market working exactly as designed. The market is very good at giving people what they'll pay for repeatedly. It's very bad at giving people what they'll pay for once.
Which is a pretty damning thing to say out loud, but hard to argue with.
Now, there are some interesting experiments on the margins. There's a store in Los Angeles called the X Store. It's run by X, the moonshot factory, which used to be Google X. They stock products that solve a real problem, and the curation is rigorous. But it's not explicitly buy it for life, and it's a single physical location that functions more as a brand showcase than a retail business.
It's a museum for Alphabet's tangents.
There's also Matter in San Francisco, a store for well-designed, durable home goods. They carry lighting, furniture, kitchen tools, textiles. The curation is strong, the aesthetic is clean, and durability is part of the ethos. But it's limited to the home category. You can't buy a flashlight or a backpack there.
It's a Bifil adjacent home store, not a general store.
That's the pattern. Every store that comes close is category constrained. Standard and Strange does raw denim, boots, and workwear, incredibly deep, very narrow. Schoolhouse Electric in Portland makes buy-it-for-life lighting fixtures, porcelain sockets, metal shades, replaceable components. But it's lighting and only lighting.
Schoolhouse Electric is actually a good example. They've been making the same designs for decades. You can still buy replacement parts for a fixture from 20 years ago.
That's the Bifil ethos in practice. Not just durability, but repairability and parts availability. But the fact that I have to name a different store for lighting, a different store for boots, a different store for kitchen tools, a different store for stationery, that's the frustration at the heart of the prompt. Nobody has put it all under one roof.
What about the digital native approach? Could a platform, rather than a store, solve the curation problem?
This is where I think the future actually lies, and it might not be a store at all. There's a model emerging that I'd call curated discovery with a durability filter. The closest existing example is a company called Bespoke Post. They do a monthly box of curated goods across categories, home, kitchen, outdoor, style, barware. It's broad, the curation is tasteful, and some of the products are durable. But durability isn't the organizing principle. Discovery is. You're not guaranteed a Bifil item, you're guaranteed an interesting one.
It's a lifestyle box, not a permanence box.
But imagine a version of Bespoke Post where every product is vetted for a minimum 5-year warranty, repairability, and material quality. That's technically possible. The supply chain exists. The question is whether enough people would pay a subscription for here's one incredibly durable thing per month to make the unit economics work.
I suspect the overlap between people who want durable goods and people who want a monthly surprise box is smaller than the pitch deck would suggest.
The Bifil buyer is, by nature, selective. They don't want a surprise. They want the exact right thing. That's why the prompt mentions doing deep research on specific items. The Bifil mindset is fundamentally incompatible with the subscription box model. You're not going to wake up and say, "Surprise me with a cast iron pan, I didn't research for 3 weeks."
That's the opposite of the Bifil pathology. The Bifil buyer has a spreadsheet.
That's not a joke. The most Bifil thing you can do is maintain a personal inventory. What you own, when you bought it, what the warranty terms are, where to get replacement parts. The prompt mentions managing warranties, and that's actually the closest thing to a solution that currently exists. You build your own Bifil store personally using the research tools available to you.
The meta insight here is that the absence of a Bifil general store is not a gap waiting to be filled. It's a signal that the market has structurally rejected the model. And the rational response is to become your own curator.
And the good news is, the tools for that are better than ever. You've got r/buyitforlife as a crowdsourced research library. You've got Project Farm and similar channels for empirical testing. You've got warranty databases and manufacturer spec sheets. You've got AI tools that can cross-reference reviews for patterns of failure. Show me every 1-star review of this blender that mentions the motor burning out. The signal-to-noise problem is still terrible on the marketplaces themselves, but the off-platform research infrastructure is remarkably good.
You just have to do the work.
You have to do the work, and I think that's the honest answer to the prompt. No, nobody has built the store you're wishing for. The people who tried either pivoted or died. The people who came close are category-constrained. The market incentives are hostile to the concept. But the tools to build your own personal Bifil store, a Notion database, an Airtable, even just a well-organized bookmark folder, are more powerful than anything a retailer could offer.
There's a practical framework here that's worth spelling out. If you're a Bifil buyer navigating the current mess, what's the workflow?
First filter, warranty. When you're searching on Amazon or anywhere else, sort by warranty length if the platform allows it. Products with 5+ year warranties are disproportionately durable. Not perfectly correlated, but it's the single strongest signal you can get without hands-on testing. A company that offers a 10-year warranty on a desk lamp has done the math on failure rates and is confident enough to put money behind it.
The warranty is a bet the manufacturer is making against themselves. If they're willing to make a big bet, that's information.
Second filter, cross-reference with the Bifil subreddit. Search the product name plus Bifil and see what comes up. Pay attention to comments about manufacturing changes. A product that was buy-fell in 2018 might be coasting on reputation while the 2024 version is cost-cut into oblivion.
They changed the formula problem.
Third filter, repairability. Can you get replacement parts? Is the product designed to be opened, serviced, and maintained? A product with a sealed battery or a glued-in component is not buy-full regardless of what the marketing says. Look for products where the manufacturer sells replacement parts directly, or where third-party parts are available.
If you can't find a teardown video, it's not buy-fell.
That's a pretty good heuristic. Fourth filter, material transparency. What is it actually made of? Stainless steel is not a material, it's a category. Is it 304 stainless, 18-8, something else? Is the wood solid or veneer? Is the leather full grain or bonded? The buy-fell subreddit is obsessive about this stuff, and for good reason, materials determine lifespan.
Fifth, total cost of ownership. This is where the misconception that buy-fell means expensive falls apart. A $50 mechanical pencil that lasts 30 years is cheaper than a $3 disposable pencil replaced every 6 months for 30 years. The math is straightforward, but most people don't do it because the upfront cost feels high.
The classic example is the cast iron skillet. A Lodge cast iron pan costs about $40 and will outlive your grandchildren. A nonstick pan costs $30 and lasts 3 to 5 years before the coating degrades. Over a 50-year period, the cast iron costs $40 total. The nonstick rotation costs somewhere between $300 and $500. The cheaper product is actually the expensive one.
The total cost of ownership framing is the buy-fell buyer's secret weapon. It reframes the purchase from, this is expensive, to this is the cheapest option over time.
It's an argument that retailers have no incentive to make, because they want you to buy the thing that needs replacing. Which brings us back to the structural problem. The entire retail ecosystem is optimized for the opposite of what the buy-fell buyer wants.
Let's talk about the one model we haven't explored, the cooperative. Could a membership-based buy-fell store work, funded by subscription fees instead of margin on disposables, where members vote on which products to stock?
This is the most interesting what-if in this whole conversation. Imagine a buy-fell cooperative with, say, 50,000 members paying $100 a year. That's $5 million in annual revenue before selling a single product. The co-op uses that money to fund the vetting process, hire testers, buy samples, commission teardowns, negotiate with manufacturers. Members vote on which products get stocked. The co-op buys in bulk and sells at near cost to members.
The economics flip. Instead of needing high turnover to cover fixed costs, the fixed costs are covered by membership fees. The store is incentivized to stock things that last, because members who are happy with their purchases renew their memberships.
The voting mechanism solves the curation problem elegantly. You don't need a central authority deciding what buy-fell means. The community defines it through collective preference. If a product disappoints, the community stops voting for it. The co-op's reputation is tied to the process, not to individual product guarantees.
It's basically a credit union for durable goods.
That's exactly the analogy. Credit unions exist because banks weren't serving certain communities well. A buy-fell cooperative could exist because retailers aren't serving durability-minded buyers. The question is whether the community is large enough and passionate enough to sustain it.
50,000 members at $100 a year feels ambitious, but not impossible. r/BIFL has 1.5 million members. If even 3% of them would pay for a curated buying experience, you're at 45,000.
The cooperative model has another advantage. It sidesteps the liability problem. The co-op isn't making claims about durability. It's facilitating collective purchasing decisions. If a product disappoints, the co-op didn't promise anything. The community simply made a collective bet that didn't pan out.
It's a fascinating idea. Has anyone actually tried it?
Not that I've found. There are buying clubs and group purchasing platforms, but nothing organized around durability as the explicit mission. It's an open opportunity.
Which is either encouraging or discouraging, depending on how you look at it. Encouraging because the idea is still available. Discouraging because if it were viable, someone probably would have done it by now.
I lean toward encouraging, but hard. The cooperative model requires community organizing skills, retail operations expertise, and a critical mass of early adopters. That's a rare combination. But the pieces are all there. The community exists, the demand is proven, the supply chain is accessible. Someone just needs to put it together.
In the meantime, the individual BIFO buyer's best strategy remains what the prompt describes: deep research, selective purchasing, warranty management, and the slow accumulation of a personal inventory of things that last. It's not as convenient as walking into a store and knowing everything on the shelf is trustworthy, but it's the reality we have.
I'd add one more practical tool to the kit. There's a warranty as curation angle that's underused. Brands like Patagonia, with their Worn Wear program, over 100,000 garments repaired since 2013, and Darn Tough with their unconditional lifetime sock warranty, and Red Wing with their Rizzoling service. These are signals. A brand that invests in repair infrastructure is a brand that expects its products to be worth repairing.
The repair program is the warranty made tangible.
L.L. Bean is the cautionary tale here. They had the gold standard, a 100% satisfaction guarantee, no questions asked, for over a century. People would bring back boots they'd worn for 20 years and get a replacement. But in February 2018, L.L. Bean changed the policy to a one-year return window with proof of purchase. People were buying used L.L. Bean products at yard sales and returning them for new replacements. The unconditional guarantee became unsustainable.
The tragedy of the commons, in flannel-lined form.
And that moment, February 2018, was a turning point. It signaled that even the most committed BIFO brands have limits. The warranty can't be the entire business model. It has to be supported by customers who act in good faith.
Which circles back to the cooperative idea. A membership model inherently selects for good faith participants. If you're paying to be part of the community, you're less likely to exploit it.
The membership fee is a screening mechanism. It filters out the yard sale arbitrageurs.
To synthesize where we've landed, the BIFO General Store doesn't exist. The closest approximations, Kaufman Mercantile, Huckbury, Matter, Schoolhouse Electric, are either dead, category constrained, or diluted by non-durable inventory. The structural reasons are economic: low inventory turnover, high vetting costs, liability exposure, and an incentive landscape that rewards disposability. The community has filled the curation gap. r/BIFL, Project Farm, warranty databases, but hasn't connected it to commerce, and the most viable path forward might be a cooperative model that hasn't been tried yet.
That's a fair summary, and I'd add that the AI angle is promising. Not AI as a shopping assistant that says people who bought this also bought that. We already have that, and it's terrible. But AI as a research tool that can cross-reference failure patterns, warranty claims, material specifications, and community sentiment across thousands of products simultaneously.
Find me a desk lamp with a metal shade, a replaceable LED module, and a minimum 10-year warranty, and show me every documented failure mode. That's a query no human curator can answer in real time, but an AI agent could.
That's where I think this is heading. The BIFO store of the future might not be a store at all. It might be an agent. You tell it what you need, it scours the available data, it returns a ranked list with evidence. The transaction still happens on some marketplace, but the curation happens before you ever see a product page.
Which makes the skill of writing precise specs, something we've talked about before, even more critical. The quality of the output depends on the quality of the prompt.
The BIFO buyer's real skill isn't shopping, it's specifying. Knowing enough about materials, manufacturing, and failure modes to ask the right questions. The prompt that started this conversation is itself a demonstration of that skill. I want a store that only stocks durable, rugged, non-consumable goods across categories. That's a spec. And the fact that the spec can't be fulfilled by the current market is not a failure of the spec, it's a failure of the market.
The wish for a BIFO store is really a wish for a world where durability is the default, not the exception. And until that world exists, we are all our own curators.
Which is not the most satisfying answer, but it's the honest one. The good news is that the tools for self-curation have never been better. The bad news is that you still have to do the work.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1938, a Tang Dynasty manuscript was discovered in the Mogao Caves near Dunhuang, cataloging the precise bureaucratic procedure for filing complaints about the quality of government-issued ink, including a form that required the complaining official to submit a sample of the defective ink, attached to the complaint with a specific type of silk thread.
The Tang Dynasty had a support ticket system.
with physical attachments. I don't know whether to be impressed or exhausted. The Bifold General Store remains a dream, but if you know of a retailer we missed, something that stocks durable, repairable, long-life products across multiple categories, email us at prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We'll compile a list for a future episode.
In the meantime, build your own. The Warranty Filter, the subreddit, the Project Farm Deep Dive, the personal inventory. It's not as convenient as a store, but it works.
This has been My Weird Prompts, episode 201. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want to support the show, leave a review wherever you listen. It helps other selectively frustrated buyers find us.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.